This is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of man's first steps on the moon, courtesy of the NASA Apollo 11 mission, which remains the most astounding and most viewed moment in the history of television. Today, Fresh Air is noting that anniversary by listening to interviews with astronauts and test pilots. And we'll start with one of the astronauts from that Apollo 11 moon mission 50 years ago, Michael Collins. While Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon on July 20, 1969, Michael Collins was orbiting in the Apollo 11 command capsule, waiting to take Armstrong and Aldrin back to Earth. 3 years before that, Collins piloted Gemini 10 and walked in space, attached to his spacecraft only by a high-tech umbilical cord. Michael Collins wrote an autobiography, then wrote a book called Liftoff about the U.S. space program. That's when Terry Gross spoke with Michael Collins in 1988. She asked him about the very start of the Apollo 11 moon mission back in July 1969.
When you were strapped down in July of 1969, waiting to head for the moon, and you heard the countdown, what were you thinking about when you heard the countdown?
I don't like countdowns. I don't like, I think you're nervous enough without someone yelling in your ear, 10, 9, 8, 7. It's totally unnecessary as far as the crew's concerned to tell them every last second preceding. I mean, we know we have a clock right there in front of us. So we know pretty much when the thing is going to go. But it's a small point that either way they want to do it is fine with me.
When you were heading toward the moon, it was Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin who were going to walk on the moon, and you were going to be in the command capsule, circling the moon as they did their walk. Now, you confess in your new book that your big fear when you were alone in the command capsule was that you wouldn't be able to make contact with the other astronauts and you'd have to leave without them.
Well, that's certainly true. I think a trip to the moon and back is a long and fragile chain of events. I think of it almost as a daisy chain. Any one link in that chain can break the entire sequence. But of all the links, the one that clearly to me was the most complicated and the most hazardous was the rendezvous, bringing them back up from the surface of the moon and having us meet at the proper time and place and join and go back home together.
How did you know that it was going to work, that you were going to be able to meet up and return together? I mean, when was that moment when you knew this is it, we've made it, we've made it?
Well, I did not know. I was worried about it. It's the rendezvous process is a relatively straightforward one, provided everything goes exactly right. But if, for example, they don't take off from the moon on time, if they're late by a few seconds or a minute, then all kinds of bad things start happening, and you have to change your entire strategy for bringing the two vehicles together. Likewise, if their gyros, let's say, their gyroscopes were tilted a little bit and they went up into some kind of a lopsided orbit, I might be able to go get them and I might not. I had some extra fuel on board, but it's very costly of fuel to change your orbit much, especially to change the direction of your orbit. And so there were just a lot of unknowns, in my mind at least, and therefore I was pleased beyond measure to see them coming like right down the center line of the highway below me. I could see that from my computer and from the information coming from their radar that things were going well, and as they got closer and closer, I started feeling better and better and more confident that we were going to carry the whole thing off.
You wrote that when they returned, you wanted to give Buzz a big smooch on the forehead, and then you were too embarrassed, so you just shook his hand.
Yeah.
So did you want to hear all about it when they got back in?
Yes, we had a lot of things to talk over, but not much time, because then that's a really busy period there. You have to transfer all their equipment back into the command module, get rid of Old Eagle, come swinging around the moon, and at exactly the right time, you have to ignite your rocket motor to break the bond of lunar gravity and to establish yourself on a trajectory that's going to come slicing into the Earth's atmosphere a couple of days later, slicing into the atmosphere at exactly the right angle.
It was interesting to me when you came back down to Earth and you landed in the water.
Yes.
The capsule was upside down for a while.
Yes.
And you had to be careful that you didn't get sick and throw up. Because what would the dangers have been if one of you had gotten sick in the suit you were wearing?
Well, they were worried about our bringing germs back from the moon. And we were immediately put into a quarantine. First, we were in a small container aboard the aircraft carrier, and then that container was flown by airplane back to Houston. We were put into a quarantine laboratory there. So the point was, whatever germs we brought with us, and we in fact brought nothing strange from the moon, but had we brought any germs with us, it was very important that we keep those germs locked up inside that suit with us, so that if we'd had to unzip the suit and get ill, the possibility existed we might contaminate our home planet here.
Boy, it would really be a hypochondriac's delight to come back from from a moon voyage and then imagine yourself coming down with disease no Earth person has ever even, heard of yet.
Well, we thought the chances of that were extraordinarily remote. Neil used to try to explain it by saying if you multiply a very, very small number, and that is the chances of our bringing any microbes back, against a gigantically large number, and that is a consequence of infecting the planet, what do you get? I don't know. You get a finite entity that's big enough to worry about, I guess.
I want to ask you about another really momentous space accomplishment in your life, and that was in July of 1966, when you were, I think, the first person in space to leave the vehicle and make contact with another space vehicle. Is that right?
Yes, that was a spacewalk leaving Gemini number 10, and floating over to an Agena, another unmanned vehicle that had been left in orbit, and retrieving from that Agena an experiment package and then bringing it back to the Gemini. And that was a little strange and a little bit different, and that's not something that you can quite choreograph like you can other parts of space. You just sort of have to see how it goes as it goes. And I had a few problems. I was trailing this umbilical cord, and there were loose pieces of metal flapping off the end of the Agena, and I was afraid that the cord was going to get entangled with the Agena, and that I was going to get wound up in a horrible mess, a ball connecting these two spacecraft. And poor old John Young, who was back in the Gemini, would have no choice but to snip my umbilical cord and leave me up there. And so it was a little tense for a while.
When you were doing your spacewalk, what could you actually see?
Oh, you can see wonderfully well. You have the whole world at your feet. Come roaring in over the Pacific Ocean. You can see in one glance all the way from Alaska to Baja California. You go across the United States in something like 6 minutes, and if you miss something, not to worry, you'll be back again in another 90 minutes and get a second look at it. This is true when you're inside the spacecraft peering out a small porthole. It's even more true when you're outside and you got this wide-angle view of the whole world below you.
Michael Collins speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. 50 years ago tomorrow, he piloted the Apollo 11 command capsule as Neil Armstrong became the first man to step foot on the moon.